Now, the notion of a second Sphinx is not a new one, but recently my friends Matt Bell and Filippo Biondi were on Matt's podcast Limitless, and Filippo brought up the Coffrey Scan team's work and how they believe they've discovered a second Sphinx, and this took the internet by storm. And to me, it seems like a great opportunity to discuss my hypothesis for the second Sphinx and why I think we're basically wasting our time looking for it in the ground. Spoiler alert. So let's talk about the second Sphinx. Let's talk about the Sphinx in general. Let's talk about ancient Egypt. Let's talk. Hi, my name is Dan, and welcome to Dedunking. This is probably not the first second Sphinx video that you've watched. I mean, this has been a topic of discussion for a hot minute now, and I like to research things a little bit more than most before I just jump in there because I try not to make mistakes. And I know there's a bunch of guys in the comment section right now going, "You always make mistakes, Tim." But at any rate, I'll keep the recap of other people's search for the second Sphinx brief, but I will mention the important bullet points. First of all would be the fact that the idea of a second Sphinx is generally rejected by most Egyptologists and archaeologists. The alternate historians, on the other hand, see evidence for this in the association between the Sphinx and the god Harmoniket. This translates to Horus on the horizon. Put a pin in that. Most videos I have seen covering this topic call Harmoniket a god, but the fact is he's one of many embodiments of Horus, the falcon-headed sun god, often depicted with the solar disk on his noodle there, right? So, the solar deity is on the horizon, embodied as a sphinx. Remember these things. Muhammad al-Adrizi was a Muslim scholar born in 1100 AD, and he wrote of a second sphinx. While he doesn't include measurements in his account, the sphinx he described was said to be smaller, made of mud bricks, and faced with stone. Much of the stone had been said to have been removed already, and the sphinx was in poor shape when al-Adrizi came upon it. Even worse for future researchers, al-Adrizi said the Nile was lapping at its feet. And science tells us the path of the Nile has shifted since then, right through the footprint of where that old sphinx was. So odds are it was washed away eons ago. But from the description, this sphinx seems more like a cheap imitation, a smaller but recognizable symbol, referencing the original but possibly co-opted for another use altogether. It certainly doesn't qualify as an equal counterpart to the Great Sphinx, not if the descriptions are true. So on to the next time in history when we see a second sphinx mentioned, something posited in 2011, almost 1,000 years later. Egyptologist Bassan el-Shama claimed there was a second sphinx to the north of the first, and that it was destroyed by a lightning strike. Now there's a mound that he points to, but beyond that, he really just has the same iconography that pretty much everybody who claims there's a second sphinx has for evidence. The next guy to make such a claim was archaeologist Dr. Rida Abdel Halim, and his claim was that this outcrop of rock was the second sphinx. And from one side, it kinda sorta looks compelling, but on the other, not so much. So in 2017, when Jerry Cannon and Malcolm Hutton posited they believed a second sphinx was located under an unexcavated mound, the mainstream response was tepid at best. Another mound, another rehashing of the same Egyptian duality symbolism, nothing conclusive. But in this, the year of our Lord 2026, the Coffrey scan team has found yet another mound and made yet another claim. This time they are using synthetic aperture radar and their proprietary software to make such a claim, but again, it's taken the internet by storm, so let's take a quick look at that. Now, I've discussed this technology in detail before, but I will cover it briefly now. If you're interested to learn more, there's a link below. Synthetic aperture radar, or SAR for short, is the practice of using a smaller satellite's radar antenna to cover a wider area, then treating the data as though it was gained through a larger aperture or antenna, synthetically. You get the idea. The technology traditionally had very low fidelity, but advances in computing allowed this data to be much more accurately collated, and now it's able to track differences down to a couple of centimeters. Now, the Coffrey scan team uses this proprietary technology to look at changes in the topography, which is the surface of the Earth, over time. Now, using that software, the team claims to be able to determine differences underground. I mean, sand is going to wiggle differently over a tunnel than it does over bedrock, and that's the basis of this technology. So it makes sense on its surface, and it does also make sense as part of the natural progression of how computing has helped synthetic aperture radar. However, the fact that this technology is proprietary is worrisome. I mean, it is in trust me, bro land. However, there are things we can use to help validate their work. For instance, the mound that they claim that's over the second Sphinx, well, this mound was not there 100 years ago, which of course is problematic. And now, to be fair, their scans are focusing on the underworld, mazes and caverns that are said to be underground, which honestly is a huge part of the Giza Plateau and much of ancient Egypt. So whether or not there's a Sphinx there, it is possible that the team found something at that site. If you want to really get conspiratorial about it, maybe they buried it with dirt to hide it. Or, I mean, maybe the conspiracy goes the other way and the Coffrey scan team isn't telling us the truth. I'll let you be the judge of that. Because here's the thing, I'm not undecided on the second Sphinx. However, as it seems clear the mound doesn't cover a Sphinx, probably not the best place to look. But that leaves the symbolism, the dualism often associated not just with the Sphinx, but with ancient Egypt as a whole, and that really can't be ignored. Nor can the fact that ancient Egypt was considered to be upper and lower, dualistic in and of itself. And oftentimes, this may well be the source of the duality that we see in the iconography. But we often see this symbolism incorporated in things that seem less associated with Upper and Lower Egypt, and that is why I think looking for a second Sphinx under the sands of ancient Egypt will only yield other ruins, never the second Sphinx. Because I believe the second Sphinx is located in the sky. The constellation Leo, to be exact, during the early dynastic periods when the largest monuments were said to have been built, including the Great Sphinx, Leo traversed the night sky in a path similar to that of the sun. Now this isn't unique, the ecliptic is the ecliptic after all, but the flooding of the Nile coincided with this, around June, and the sun and Leo would meet in the mornings of these days. This meant the lion in the sky held the sun on the horizon. Horus of the horizon. Hence the meaning of the name Harmaket. According to their beliefs, the sun went through the Duat, or the Egyptian underworld, every night. And Osiris, the god of the underworld, was the guide of the boat that went through the sky river, through the Duat, and back to the sky every morning to begin the new day. Horus is a son of Osiris and is usually depicted as this falcon-headed god with the big old solar disk on his noggin. His right eye was said to be the sun, and his left eye was said to be the moon, and when he took to flight, well, the sun and the moon went through the sky. But the Sphinx, well, that's Harmaket, which, like I said, means Horus of the horizon, or it could mean Horus in the horizon. And this is partly why the Sphinx faces due east. It was the outcrop of bedrock selected eons ago because it was oriented to the rising sun. Now, I've covered this a long time ago, but to be simple about it, during the Green Sahara period, around 12,000 to 6,000 years ago, the Nile River would often reach the base of the outcrop of rock that eventually became the Great Sphinx. Now, this water was usually only a few inches deep, leaving that outcrop looking like an island piercing the waters, a mountain coming through the Nile River, an island that was accessible and oriented to the sun. I believe this is the source of the myth of the primordial mound in ancient Egypt. When they talk about creation, they talk about the first piece of dirt coming up through the water. I personally believe that this is the piece of dirt they spoke of, which is also the origin of the Benben, or the Benben stone, or the Pyramidion, the capstone of the pyramids, which is now missing. The Benben was said to have been synonymous with that primordial mound. Well, I personally believe that when the Sphinx was carved, which I do believe in its first carving had a feline head, that a leftover piece of stone was saved and venerated as the Benben, probably a piece of that original outcrop that was used to pinpoint the sun, peak that had been sacred removed and now a capstone for pyramid after pyramid after pyramid, in my opinion, transferring its mystical power all across ancient Egypt. In my opinion, this is why there's a pit around the Sphinx enclosure, not to facilitate the paws being carved nearly as much as the Nile slowly receded. And as the Nile slowly receded, well, there wasn't water around this primordial mound sticking up out of the water anymore. Now, this primordial mound was aligned with the rising sun, so it was still really cool that way, but it wasn't sticking up out of the water, so dig a trench around the thing, and now it fills with water, and it keeps water in it, right? So now you've got a little artificial lake around the thing, and it still has a symbolic purpose. But as the water no longer covered that area, and the sun no longer rose into Leo on the spring equinox, that connection became lost. The connection between the sky and the ground and the water, it all just fell to pieces. The water, they tried to bring in with that pit, but the lion, the connection was just not as potent as it once had been. But a few thousand years later, Leo once again traversed the night sky and happened to be housed by the rising sun. Right about the time that the Nile flooded, once again seemed like the Horus of the horizon, or in the horizon, was smiling on the two Egypts. And the mythology around the afterlife is just as important as the creation side of it is, in my opinion. The ancient Egyptian afterlife journey was said to go through an underworld, the darkness that occupied the night sky, and it was part of the tunnels and caverns under the two lands. During this journey, a series of trials were undergone, the most famous being a weighing of a heart against a feather. These tests were numerous and oftentimes seemingly impossible, and preparation was critical for a successful journey. For the rank-and-file Egyptian, this afterlife journey was going to be less of a trial and more of a mess. From what we can gather, it seems they weren't going to be properly equipped or educated for what they were going to need to do to get through this journey. Big surprise there. And personally, I believe that these tests were reenacted with the body of the deceased in the real world. A journey over the Nile, stopping at key locations in order to assist the pharaoh's travels through the afterlife. Now, the underworld, or the Duat, was not just the caves and the darkness and the upside down, but it was also basically the twilight zone. It was a specific location in the sky. It was the spot between dawn and dusk, and in that area is where the magic was, right? And so this is the spot where Egyptian nobility tried to end up. Now, if you were just a rank and file noble, well, you could be a star. But if you were a really cool noble, like, I don't know, say a pharaoh, you could end up as potentially part of the sun god Ra's entourage, and you could roll around the sky every day pushing dung beetle poop. Or they had some weird beliefs, man. I don't know what to tell you. And this is why I believe the second Sphinx is in the sky. Their beliefs in the afterlife and the powers of the universe were intertwined with the sky and the Nile River. The duality of the two lands, in my estimation, spread into the duality between Upper and Lower Egypt, the symbolism becoming part and parcel of their worldview. As above, so below, they say. This is why we see two Thutmoses portrayed on the dream stela. One is ministering to the earthbound Sphinx, the other one to his heavenly counterpart. In other words, Leo. In this image, he's proclaiming not only his intention to care for the earthly lion, but the sky lion as well. And this is why the two Sphinxes are always portrayed facing exactly opposite of each other, because they exist upside down of each other, right? And basically, we're wasting our time digging in the ground if we're looking specifically for another Sphinx. I mean, we've known where the second Sphinx was for a very long time, although we didn't know it was a second Sphinx until Robert Bival, not me. This is important to give a quick shout out to. Robert Bival was the first person to posit that the Sphinx and Leo were connected. His work, best outlined in the book he co-authored with Graham Hancock, Message of the Sphinx, details how the Sphinx and Leo were intertwined 12,000 years ago, and the pyramids were also said to be part of this, with the three stars of Orion's belt emulated on the ground, and the Nile River and the Milky Way meeting on the horizon, again as an earthly counterpart to the heavens. And I believe this is why the pyramids were built where they were, As I earlier mentioned, the Sphinx was best aligned to Egyptian mythology 12,000 years ago, so it stands to reason they would try to emulate this sacred time in their architecture. In fact, the time of creation was known as Zeptepi, or the first time, and was considered extremely sacred by the ancient Egyptians. It was a time when the gods walked with the mortals, and miracles were common. So when the Sphinx in the sky once again heralded life in the form of being perceived to bring the Nile floods, the connection to Zeptepi was felt to be strong, and some of that power was incorporated into the structures of the Fourth Dynasty. At least that was the idea. I mean, the idea they captured any magic in the pyramids of the Sphinx is pretty crazy if you think about it, but maybe it's not so crazy. If you really, really think about it, here we are talking about these things thousands of years later, no matter whose timeline you go by, and ultimately, why? Really, why? If you stop and think about it, why? It's like the world's obsessed with these. No matter what side of the spectrum you fall on, people are freaking crazily obsessed with these. And so, well, we've got all these different ideas about what could be under the sands of Egypt, which I am very, very much looking forward to seeing. I would love nothing more than to see the Khafre scan team's technology bear out to be really accurate. I would love to see it. Time will tell. But in the meantime, looking for tunnels and labyrinths and even entire subterranean cities isn't insane under the sands of ancient Egypt if you read the accounts of the explorers from the Greek times. Now, I know that makes me a nut job. I mean, all you have to do is read the ancient text and it will tell you where to look to find so many amazing things. The only problem is getting past the people who hold the keys to allowing you to look. Now, before I go, I have a thought experiment for you. Imagine you're trying to have a shared experience with somebody from 12,000 years ago, and they lived right where you do. What would you choose? Food? Morality? Haircuts? I could. Hunting techniques? There's a lot of things you could pick, but what would actually work? How about this? Going outside when there is minimal light pollution and looking straight up at the stars, like Orion's belt, you would see almost exactly what that person saw. Almost exactly. And you may or may not use what I just told you as a key to the past, as you see fit. At any rate, I'll be in Sedona, Arizona, May 1st through 3rd for the Quest for Ancient Civilizations Conference. The link to purchase tickets is down below. It's going to be freaking awesome. We're going to be not just talking about a whole bunch of alternative theories and a whole bunch of cutting-edge learning stuff. I know some of the people say that we don't do any advancement and we don't learn anything, but those of you who are in the know in our community know we pick up new ideas all the time, and there's going to be a bunch of that stuff presented right then and there in just under a month from now. If you don't want to purchase tickets to that, you can watch it from the web cinema-nemar. Down below, I think that's the British pronunciation, but I have to tell you, you won't get to kick it with me and drink and smoke that devil's lettuce if you're at the web seminar. I'll tell you what you can do, though. You can click buttons down below to support the channel, which I would also appreciate. It will allow me to buy seminar for the seminar. I want to thank you all very much for watching. I hope you found this video informative. I really appreciate the digging for the Second Sphinx. I appreciate the legwork. And honestly, we may well find a lot of stuff from this SAR scan data. However, the Second Sphinx is in the sky. I'm pretty certain about that. Have a good day. Hope to see you next time.